Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our poetry panel this afternoon, A Revolution in Poetic Language. My name is Jessica Alice. I'm your chair for this session. I'm the artistic director of the Byron Writers Festival in Byron Bay and was formerly the CEO of Writers SA. So it's lovely to be back in Adelaide and seeing so many familiar faces. I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on sovereign unceded Kaurna Yatta and pay respects to elders past and present. And acknowledge that this is country that has held stories and people sharing language and culture for millennia. So it's a privilege for us to be here on this special country. Thank you for joining us for this very special session this afternoon. I'm delighted to introduce you to our panel, fabulous poets. We're going to have some conversation, the Savo. We're going to hear some poetry as well. So I'm thrilled for what you're about to hear. I'll introduce the panel. To my left, Evelyn Araluen. Evelyn is a Guri and Koori poet. Yes, you are right to applause.
Nothing. I've done nothing.
Researcher and co-editor of Overland Literary Journal. We love Overland. Her Stella Prize-winning poetry collection, Drop Bear, was published by UQP in 2021, and she lectures in literature at creative writing at Deakin University. I can't quite see you. Madison Godfrey is a writer. Yes, please clap. Please clap. Is a writer, editor, educator, and the author of two poetry collections. Their writing is described as, I love these descriptions, sensual and often funny by The Guardian, and fiercely punk and undeniably powerful by Arts Hub. Madison's recent book, Dress Rehearsals, was listed as one of the most anticipated releases of 2023 by Refinery 29, Rush Magazine, and the Sydney Morning Herald. Madison has performed poetry at the Sydney Opera House, the Royal Albert Hall, St. Paul's Cathedral, and Glastonbury. So impressive.
Shoot, wait, how did that happen?
Just walked in.
Ellen Van Nieuwen is a writer. Yes, Ellen Van Nieuwen is a writer of Munanjali, Yugambeh, and Dutch heritage. Van Nieuwen's first book, Heat and Light, won the David Unaipon Award, the Dobby Literary Award, and the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards Indigenous Writers Prize. They are the author of two poetry collections, Comfort Food and Throat, which won the Kenneth Slessor Prize, the Multicultural New South Wales Award, and Book of the Year in New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. And Jill Jones is a writer and poet whose books include Wild Curious Air, which was the winner of the 2021 Wesley Michael Wright Prize, and The Beautiful Anxiety, which won the Victorian Premier's Prize for Poetry in 2015. Her work is widely published in Australia, Canada, Ireland, Aotearoa, Singapore, Sweden, UK, and the USA. She has worked as an academic, arts administrator, journalist, and book editor. And her latest book is Acrobat Music, New and Selected Poems. Please welcome the panel. So this session today, we're here to talk about, I suppose, political poetry and poetry of resistance. And I think we're acknowledging that some of those terms can mean a lot of different things. So I thought to start, I'd love to ask each of you about your own work and the way that you view your poetic work and its relation to the political. Alan, perhaps if we start with you, how do you conceive of your work in that realm?
Good afternoon, everyone. Jingiri, I want to acknowledge Kaurna land and Kaurna people. I approached the question thinking about how my work is held. And so I think of my poetry as being held in the traditions of Indigenous poetry, queer and trans poetry, feminist poetics, and justice poetics more broadly. I'm very much comes from the place where I'm from, Southeast Queensland, and the, you know, the people and influences that that place has had on me and still continues to have on me.
Mm. Beautiful. How about you, Jill?
I write from the perspective, obviously, of a woman, and also a lesbian or LGBTQIA plus perspective. I also want to think about the earth, and you know, the earth, that can be quite a contentious thing, and what is going on to our world, within our world. But one thing, and I'm not using it necessarily in the second wave feminism idea, but I think of the personal as being political. And what I mean by that is our bodies are political. And at the language that comes out of our bodies, in whatever way it does, is political. And resistance, if we get back to that term, can mean to fight, but it can also mean to weather and withstand. And some of what I do is along those lines rather than the other.
Mm, beautiful. Evelyn?
Yeah, Jingiwala, very lucky to be a guest here on Kana Yoda. I have been asked varying versions of the question about the poetic and the political a lot in different kind of literary contexts, and every single time I just give a completely different response to that question. So take none of this as any kind of gospel. But I think poetry being such a communal and historical and dialogic form, you know, like unless you're writing quite bad poetry, when you write poetry, you're probably thinking of poetry you've read or you've heard read or performed, and it's always in some particular form. There are threads in conversation with each other. So I think in that sense of language and meaning and intention, you know, we can only ever really see all the various, you know, new life forms of a poem and the way that it can morph, or language and meaning can morph from one person to another, story to another. You know, you can only view that politically when you think about who has access to speak to what story, who is, you know, positioned to speak, who is not allowed to speak, and as well, you know, whose voices are withheld, whether it be from the mainstream or whether it be from, you know, their own human right to articulate their experiences, particularly their suffering. So yeah, I think poetry exists in a deeply political landscape of access and transformation and dialogue and opportunity. My poetry sometimes, you know, addresses with varying forms of volatility and resentment, you know, particular sets of politics, usually around Aboriginal sovereignty, language, you know, the rights and autonomy of Aboriginal people to practice culture. But a lot of the time it's also about weird little silly things of very low political stakes. And I think that in itself is a privilege to be able to, you know, playfully demean myself in that way. And it's still political. It has to maintain a kind of political function in society. But, yeah, you know, we contain multitudes, and some of the multitudes of my poetry I consider to be volatile, and some of them I consider to be incredibly unserious.
Well, there's also, I mean, part of that is also, I think there's often maybe an expectation as well for some, and I think particularly for some poets, and probably particularly First Nations poets, to be political or are sort of presumed to be political all the time, perhaps.
What do you reckon, Maddie?
Yeah, I think I've thought too much about this today because I've got into this like spiraling deep hole. But I want to start by saying how grateful I am to be visiting this land, Kaurna land, and pay my respects. And also say that I live and work and teach on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja over the other side of this country. And I'm really grateful to be a visitor on this land and for the opportunity to write and to even consider politics on this land that is stolen. When I think about this panel, and yeah, maybe I am spiraling, I've been thinking a little bit too much about why some poets are considered political and why that's considered like a denotation or an identification of difference, right? I've been thinking a lot about my book and the things I love doing and the way that I love poetry and I love craft and I love the histories of poetry and its relationship to protest. Those of you who have heard me speak throughout this festival will have heard me speak about punk music and the Riot Girl movement and these kind of like histories that I come from with my poetics. But I've also been thinking a lot about the fact that my poetry is often referred to as queer poetry, or that this is like a collection, a queer book, where we never hear of like, oh, this is a straight book, or this is a white book, or these are white poems. These are.
I say that about people all the time.
Yeah, that's why I love you. But like, I just think that like the notation versus the denotation and this like identification of difference as inherently political, it's something that I'm really grappling with and chewing on today, because I think poets that consider themselves not political are still political. They're just enforcing a dominant expectation of who's speaking and who's allowed to speak and who's published. So I think I'm thinking a lot about this panel and these beautiful people who I'm with and why I love their work and why I read their work and study their work so deeply. And it isn't necessarily because of politics, but because of also like love and power and resilience and community and what I learn from them. But yeah, so I guess I'm coming in with questions more than answers today. Maybe I'll just be like the disruptor of the panel. And I also am really grateful for like the lineage of queer poetics and political poetics that I do still live within and I do still benefit from as a young trans person. Yeah. Mm. Lots of questions. There you go.
Well, let's hear some poetry. I'd love it, Alan, if you could give us our first reading for the session.
Does anyone else want to go first? I think, you know, we were also talking earlier about just poets that inspire us and have, you know, what I like about poetry is it's so relational and it's, you know, works are related to each other like a family. So you can read a poet and you can read their influences in their work. And yeah, for me, some of my influences are Lisa Belair, Natalie Harkin, Claudia Rankine, Jericho Brown. These are all Audre Lorde. These are all poets that you can, I think, if you've read their work, you can feel it in my work as well. Mm-hmm. So I will never not be inspired by those poets and keep them close at the bedside table. A friend of mine, I just moved house and a friend of mine gave me the best advice in terms of like making my new place feel homely and safe. And that was to, yeah, sort of, even though you don't necessarily want to unpack all the books, and yes, most of them are still in boxes, just find, you know, the books that you your favorite books and sort of unpack them and put them beside the bed, and then you can sort of feel like you're not alone and feel like the place is sort of uplifted with those feelings and that strength and power of the work. So, you know, I was sort of tossing and turning about whether reading something from Throat or reading sort of newish work, I guess. And I think I'm going to read this this poem that is very new. It takes me a long time to sort of work towards a collection. It's really, yeah, it's really something that I'm just thinking about now. So yeah, I'll read this work. It's called Strong Flower. Flower never thought they had stories inside them. They grew up quietly moving in an eternal forest. They liked reading science fiction and playing sport. Both things did not require speaking sentences. Flower's extended family were legendary around this country. Together, they were as wide as the headwaters on the mountain, but they were dispersed like grass heads across lands and never all together. Flower remembers their grandmother like a wind. When she passed away, they grieved through running. They were always faster around the bend in the last 100 meters, as if carried by a strong force. Flower grew up with the worry that they would never be right. This became a bigger worry that they would never be good. Flower was told by a relative that gay people deserved punishment and humiliation. Even their best friend in high school, with his beautiful, kind blue eyes, seemed to believe this was true. They tried to make the boy with the blue eyes love them, to save them both at a Christian rock concert, but this didn't work. Connections were easily made online than in the suburbs. Though computers were communal, not personal, and discretion was key when projecting thoughts to other planets. Queensland was a vivid place. In 1997, Pauline Hanson declared Aboriginal people were cannibals and Australia would be run by an Asian cyborg lesbian president by 2050. We've still got 24 years. It was 33 years before Flower knew they were a strong flower from a strong river. Rare and tough, with fibrous and bright green leaves, they lived silently amongst birds. It took time before they found their form, strong like a spear, delicate like dew. Their spike grew from the center in winter. In spring, their red-brown rosette flashed against the blue sky. Words deeply soaked their tearful roots. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you for sharing something new. That's a bit of a privilege for us.
Why not, right? Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Stunning. I'd love to hear, Maddie, maybe we could hear something from you. And I wonder, though, if you could, I mean, Alan mentioned some of their influences and some of the writers whose work has been pretty formative for them. Who is that for you?
Also, that was brilliant, thank you. And I have lots of questions to ask you after about it, but thank you. I've been reading, so I like that the title today is like a revolution in poetic language, not necessarily in poetry, because lately I've been reading both in like response to everything happening right now and in response to like my own cherished youth of literary like influence, just James Baldwin nonstop. But sort of going back to like essays and then kind of like bridging from there, I always say that James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room was the book that made me quit all my science subjects at school. I was probably 16 and someone gave me like a paperback copy. I remember it vividly. And at that point, I was on track to be a forensic scientist. Surprise, didn't happen. Sorry, Dad. Yet, maybe never. I think I'm done. I think I just watched too much of that show Bones. And so like I read this book by James Baldwin, and it was the first time that I understood what literature could do. Like, I think it was the first time that I actually felt the aliveness and the purpose of a book. And I've thought a lot about that as a pivotal moment for me at 16 when I didn't understand so much of the world or so much of myself that maybe you can now link that book to in hindsight. But it wasn't about that. It was, for me, it was about a feeling and a momentum. And so coming back now, over 10 years later, how can I count? 12 years later, maybe? Yeah. 12 years later, and rereading Baldwin, and starting from like kind of like earlier speeches and then listening to speeches as well, has been really interesting. So right now, that's my thought. But there are also so many who I can't think of right now unless I can point at my shelf. Yeah. I also really wanted to read like a very joyous poem today. I was looking through the book, and there are a lot of poems that feel angry or overtly political, and I've been thinking a lot about the purpose of love and the purpose of joy in resistance. And so I'm going to read maybe the silliest poem in my book or the happiest poem in my book, which is an ode, and I'm thinking a lot about love as well as politics. Ode to my kneecaps. You who contribute to holding me up but never take the credit. You silent sermon in the collapsing cathedral hall of my body. You lyrics after the chorus, living forgotten in the liquid center of noise. You tougher, larger, rounder knuckles. You grazed excuse for an epiphany. You always prepared for impact. You who have never been complimented. You shield sewn into my nonchalance. You good ending to a bad story. Ode to my kneecaps, who I always slice during shaving. You, the canvas of my clumsiness. You who click your invisible tongue at cold weather. Oh, kneecaps, you equator of ankle and thigh. You who feel the breeze through torn windows of my dungarees. Oh, kneecaps, you insistent creases. You section of wandering skull. You who have never been itchy. You unsubtle bone, not bothering to hide. Oh, kneecaps, you twin peaks. You rock hard boob shapes. You carpet burn after coitus. You altar of romance. You who have never been too big or too small for an outfit. You cement poured in by my parents. You faulty GPS I was born with. You flag who has only ever felt half-mast. Ode to my kneecaps, the breadwinner of my body, the bruise winner of my best dance moves. There are so many odes to collarbones. I'm sorry I didn't look lower sooner. You unassuming barricade. A mountain I can curl around on the train ride home. If I can add, I also am thinking a lot about what it means to experience joy or document joy in bodies we're taught or we're told don't experience it. And I think I've been thinking a lot about the expectations and the narratives around transness or around queerness and this expectation of dysphoria or discomfort in one's own body, a lack of pleasure, a lack of beauty. And so I think today my choice to read that poem, I was thinking about the ways I love to move my body and the ways I love this body, and that being a kind of almost a political narrative in the ways of joy and pleasure, because it goes against what we're told to expect and the narratives and the stories we're repeatedly given in media and in articles and in most narratives about what trans people experience inside a body. That isn't to say that those other narratives don't exist. They are real and they do exist, and the trans experience is varied and wide and contains light and moments and also heavier moments. But yeah, today I wanted to share joy for that reason. Mm. So thanks for listening.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about the love and joy and continuing on is all a part of resistance. Maddie, you mentioned the title of the session, which is refers to poetic language, and revolution in poetic language is the title of a Julia Kristeva text, probably one of the more dense literary theory texts of that oeuvre. Without getting too much into it, one of the like the theses of that book is that poetic language or poetry has a quality that what she calls is the semiotic, and that it sits outside of the symbolic order. So I suppose if the symbolic order is kind of the everyday that we find ourselves in, like linear language. I'm not sure if Kristeva calls it patriarchal, but you know, sort of the authoritative everyday sort of use of language. And then poetry has this ability to tap into the semiotic, which is pre-language. You know, it has this connection to like maybe the body. It sort of exists outside of order. So there's a lot in it. But there's something about this inherent quality, which she's getting at, is about some inherent qualities of poetry. And so I suppose I wanted to ask you all what you think about what it is about poetry. And what that makes me think of is when in times of crisis, perhaps, and sometimes at times of celebration, at sort of significant moments, it seems that poetry often rises above into a public consciousness, perhaps more so than at other times. So I wondered if any of you had reflections on that, and how poetry has that ability to rise above other forms of language at particular moments, or if it does, maybe you disagree. Might have been a bit too much Kristeva.
I think we move between, especially now, I think we are moving between the radical, imaginary, possibility, liberatory impulse of putting language to its most emotive use in the need to feel that some alchemy of words that allows us to externalize an internalized pain that is coming from a screen for most of us, but the other end of a phone call for some of us, you know, somebody in another room, in a family member on the other side of the world. It's tempting to think that language can take that and make it make sense. Language can give words to something in the way that we feel powerless to do. And I understand that impulse, and I've used language as a crutch. In many instances, I've used poetry as a crutch. I've felt like poetry can do something when we feel like we can do nothing. Mm. But I think it's easy to become too reliant on the idea that language itself can be radical when the action that's required by language is not followed through. Mm. I will never fucking forgive people who have decided to write poems about Palestine instead of doing anything about Palestine. And what we will see now, we've already been seeing it, but we will see it further in years to come, that the act of witnessing what we're witnessing will become creative material for people with no real legitimate felt stake in the genocide that we have essentially in this country funded. Well, not essentially, we did fund. And that's a genre. It's a genre of creative expression that pre-exists this horror. But the notion that one can use words to do something about immense human suffering is insufficient, I feel. It's horrendously insufficient. And I'm not saying you can't write poetry about Palestine. It's none of my bit. I don't get to say that. But I am certainly saying that for people who think that, you know, creative articulation of their personal felt expression of pain and grief when it's not happening to them, that's not good enough. That's tremendously not good enough, and we won't feel, you know, empowered. Free fucking Palestine, doll. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. This is the reality, right? You can get insecure about that and you can feel personally affronted by that, but language isn't going to do enough. Making an accusation to somebody isn't going to do enough in that kind of instance. Coming up and walking out of a poetry reading when it's about the political isn't going to do anything, and me calling it out isn't actually going to do anything. The reality is that what we need to be doing is we need to force a constant, focused conversation that can put accountability into a political structure. It doesn't mean that we can't write poetry, but if that's the only thing that we're doing, you know, we can hang our heads in shame.
Who are some of the writers who you feel are as, and maybe not as activists, but like to you, who are some of the writers, we've spoken about some of the writers whose work we really, really admire. Who for you is doing that really good work that when maybe the work isn't all that's required, but their way of engaging, the work that they do is what we want to see as poets and our roles in a civic kind of space, in public space.
Did you want to answer that, Jill?
Sorry?
Did you want to go with that one?
Oh, right. Okay, me.
Yeah.
One of the books I read quite recently, How to Wash a Heart by Banu Kapil.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it's not my experience. I let her tell me or write her experience of being a guest but not really feeling at home. By being a guest of white people. And they do everything they think they are doing right for her, but she can never be that. I reread that book every so often. I mean, she's a fabulous writer. and she's written many other things as well. But just to, for me to sit with that, I mean, I'm a white person, obviously. So I think about that. I think, I'm so glad you mentioned Baldwin. And I've started to go back to reading James Baldwin again. Didn't specifically... Oh, he did write some poetry, yeah. I also... This is going back a bit, but maybe I could mention this because these things keep repeating themselves. But on September the 11th, but not the one you're thinking of, 1973... In Chile, Augusto Pinochet overthrew the democratically elected government, ably assisted by the United States. And during the period of that regime, people were murdered, disfigured, disappeared, desaparecidos. Sorry, my Spanish is non-existent. And one of the people who was there, a Chilean, called Raul Zurita, the poet. And I heard him read a few years ago in Berkeley. He was a very unassuming man. But he did some extraordinary things. I mean, he knew people who... Yeah, he's still alive, obviously, but friends of his who are not. They were put in concentration camps, all the rest of it. And he wrote all these poems about the Atacama Desert, because it was revealed that, amongst other things, people were thrown out of helicopters and they died in the desert. So he wrote a poem in the desert, and he wrote about that desert, he wrote about that place. And at another time in New York, in about 1982, he had these poems or lines put up in the sky. I think, if I may, I could just... I can't find them, it doesn't matter. And they were poems for Chileans, for Hispanics in North and South America, and for any people that had experienced that. And again, I thought, he's done so much compared to, I sit and write. I mean, I do, I've done other things. And I go back to his work and think about that as well. I won't go on, but, you know, there are so many different... On the other hand, my in to, you know, writing, I guess, as an out lesbian was Adrienne Rich. Mm. 21 love poems. So I'll stop there.
Well, would you read something for us, Jill?
Okay, I will. I was going to read something a bit angry, but I won't. And I just lost my place. I had it and I put it down. Here we go. And following up what Maddie was saying, that... particularly for LGBTQIA plus folks, if I can put it like that, queer, to actually write a love poem, for me to write a poem of love to another woman, can be political. Mm. Because, A, it's a declaration, but also if there's someone out there who's quite closeted about how they feel, to read that... I'm not saying read one of my poems necessarily, but to read one of those poems I think is political, because they see that they're not alone and maybe they can step out into the world and own that love or that attraction or the way their body feels about it. So I'm going to read a poem that I guess some people who know my works... I always usually set it somewhere, often in streets and offices. I did a lot of that. And where we are in our bodies, and that's why I said the personal is political, because our bodies are always somewhere, and maybe they're being ignored or taken notice of, depending on who we are. I remember hearing Sarah Ahmed talking recently about the table and who's at the table, who can speak at the table and who isn't even at the table. But I'm talking about work. O Venus that zenith. In the morning media rustle, we look for our vertebrae, our balance, anything sensible, shoes or day cream, encase our nipples, although we fancy being free, as the train gushes and swallows tickets and selfies, high-vis and daydream. Then the city's coarse daylight opens its cracks, the paving jerk, escalator drag, a last gulp, so our mouths might swell with sexual tannins, a cafe smoke tongue before swipe and thrust. Goodbye, cruel air, you weepy green trees, crushed yellow light. The lift slackens to the 10th floor. We remember nothing now apart from the gash in night. Good old dogs sleep, running around under red moon and white cliffs, and how we fall there and there. Oh, Venus, I don't forget you in the spread of tinted morning, the grids. I've wandered far in circles around your heights without shoes or sensibilities. I don't forget you and how I've climbed into another balance, cusp, flexure, fold, another arc and then another.
Thank you, Jill. Stunning.
Just a quick... Were you talking Sarah who wrote Flirtation of Girls? Yes, who you might have seen here in the festival earlier. Mm. I just wanted to note her. Flirtation of Girls, there were copies in the bookstore and there might still be there as well if you want more poetry other than what's on stage to grab after the session. Yeah, just a good suggestion.
One of my favourite books of recent times, for sure.
Yeah.
Love it. I love where, of course, we're going to push some poetry propaganda while we're here. And Evelyn, how about you? We're talking about the people whose work we really admire, before we hear a poem of yours, who's doing it for you?
So I've been reading this beautiful book that there were only like 100 copies printed. My friend had to get it secretly smuggled from America. It was produced in the 80s. It was this translated book of Palestinian poets under incarceration, and I've been reading that, and it's really tragic because we don't know any of the details of their names or the translations, so I can't really talk about it individually, but I've been reading and adoring that. I've talked many times about how much I just like love Aboriginal women's poetry, and that's on record. But you know, beyond that space, I adore the Marxist poets of the riot. You know, like Sean Bonney is forever like etched into my heart, and his work. You know, a lot of people know ACAB Lullaby, and I just think the articulation of, you know, like, don't say I love you, say fuck the police, is just like that does something to my brain that will never go away. I've been reading a lot of June Jordan, who's been writing incredible work about Palestine as well. And Ellen's already mentioned Claudia Rankine, but I just think she's a genius, and her, you know, a lot of people like feel like they know Claudia, and then you've really just got to sit down and read her books, and it's like, you know, she's always got more for you than you realise. So I've been enjoying reading those. And recently, Kestin Sutherland, who was in Adelaide a couple of months ago, he's a Marxist poet from the UK, and his poetry is very strange, but he's propelled by this like belief in desire and this belief in like genuine human goodness that I just find is so heartening. Don't understand half the poetry, but I like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read two not that long poems, but keep in mind that both of them are like either very much, like I was literally just editing one of them on a Google Doc just then because I've been only recently writing poetry. And this is another one of those cases. If people were here the other day, I read a poem that I hadn't read at all yet, and then I just like burst into tears. So I'm really hoping we don't do that.
I gotcha if you do.
Thank you. We're going to try and get through it. I've been writing sad poetry about Mitski, if people know Mitski.
Yes.
Yes.
Love Mitski.
Yeah, it's a real, her energy is right for these times. So this is untitled. My baby, my baby, my baby, you're my baby. Say it to me, I say to the humid bath air, to the dog asleep under the moon. Seaweed, rose jam, white claws, and you, Mitski, in your amber halo of misery, the prophet of rotting girls. Last night I promised I would not drink tonight, weep in the bath, eat dinner, or watch the news. I want to feel it, I tell the tiles and the mold, as if there is a choice but to keep bracing against the world, the algorithm we taught what we could bear. I bet on losing dogs, you croon slow and sad. So let's raise a glass to that, to the cracked light collecting at our feet, to these, the oldest themes and the worst. But for that light, the moon, the dogs, the group chat where we recount our days, a snake stretching the fire trail, my nephew kicking his first ball. In the other window, a boy the same age, his body scattered through the rubble. Mitski, so much of this is unlivable. So much of this can't hold our gaze back. Oh, Mitski, how can we love each other through these histories? On the way back from the rally, I am told your father was in the CIA. I am so willing to let this be apocryphal. But today, I walked arm in arm with Palestine, my body bracing itself to mourn. I am mourning a vote I didn't want, a history I will never accept. And you are so far away in America, the imperial killing machine. But in this bathtub, we are both grieving our living, loving mothers. In this bathtub, you echo across cracked tiles where I am thinking of rivers, thinking of kissing your tears forever. Thinking, if we can survive our minds, then let us drown together. So clean at last, so fresh. Let us give this grief to the other world. Don't you feel it pressing against ours, Mitski? Don't you feel it begging the trees to bleed? But for gum blossom, the whales, this blunt witnessing of history. Mitski, give me the power to avenge the things I cannot live with. If you gave me back those howling hours, I would howl again. And that was longer than I thought it was, so I'll just do that.
Oh. I don't know, do the other one as well.
Oh, God. Okay, all right. I had to get my husband to text this to me because it's a rework of another poem of mine. It's called For Power, For Prayer, For Promise, For Peace. And this is very much after June Jordan and Sean Bonney. In the absence of power, say we will not forget. In the thoughts and prayers, say we will not settle for silence. For those who are waiting, we promise we will not leave. If there will be no justice, we will not permit peace. The bloodied face of history is black, is teeth spilling from a mouth that won't swallow its own tongue. The face of history is a death mask smothered against beautiful black, is a bullet to the back, is a body to the wall, is holy like howling to forever, that the sky has another star to burn. The prayer for peace says second to send grief to the soil, but take the soil back. Says there are some things too hallowed for forgetting, too much of history to forgive. The fury, the gun, the cell, the throat, nothing more holy, nothing more left to lose. No Lord, no glory, only our blood back to the earth, only mothers weeping to the street, only a child's scream in the night. The poem says, speak the aftermath of history. The wall says, from the river to the sea. The cry on the street says, say their names. Against every ceremony we trace to journey them home, say the thing that will bind them here until we might let them leave with justice. If you say forgiveness, tell them to lift their boot from your neck.
Thank you. And again, another. We're so privileged to be hearing these, these new pieces, these unpublished pieces from some of these incredible poets. So I'm thankful for you all for sharing so much with us. It's incredibly generous. Something that I wanted to ask a little bit more before, and I think I was sort of getting there, and then we were rudely interrupted. Which I have to say,
I hope she's having a nice little sit down or a drink somewhere. I, you know, have a lovely afternoon, doll.
Yeah, I have to say that I don't think we should be yelling out at our poets on stage. But what I wanted to get to was about the role of not necessarily the poet activist, but about the role of the poet. In a world, like what we think that is, and acknowledging that that obviously in whatever movement it is, whatever struggle, there are practical things that we do. But I wonder, like, as the role of art and engaging in a political realm, how you see that that place and what it is for you, if it's a responsibility or if it's the function or something that you feel kind of driven to do. I wonder if any of you would like to speak on that and how you see the poet and their place, and whether it's about documentation, whether it's about, providing, leadership or reflecting our communities, what that might be for you.
I often tell my students and think about poetry at its best as the act of noticing. People often come to me and say, like, I want to write a poem, or I want to be a poet, and I feel like I need to do a university degree, or I need to do all these strange institutional qualifications, and I challenge them to go and notice the world instead. I think at its best, poetry is not just noticing but looking at things and not looking away when they're uncomfortable. And that can link to a variety of political topics, but the ability to see things and then to try your best to find language or to record it, I think that's a core component of how I teach and how I talk about poetry. And it's sort of the poetry that I'm loving the most right now, is that which is noticing. Mm. Anyone else?
Ellen. What do you reckon?
I like tennis. We'll just hit it. Ellen?
You said tennis, and I was like, are we talking about tennis? because I would love to have that conversation. But no, I think, for those of you who don't know, have recently published a book about sport.
Yeah.
I think, and it's prose, and I think as someone who writes poetry and prose, I was thinking about that question, and I was like, is there a different function or a different role that poetry has that's distinct to other forms of writing? I don't know if anyone has any thoughts or feelings about that. Picking up what you said about noticing the world, I really do think about poetry and the poetry that I'm inspired to write and read, and the works that I have, also an editor of poetry and work with writers really closely. I think about testimony. I think about the sort of embodiment of I'm here. I'm here on the page in voice. You know, it was lovely to hear my fellow poets read today. But there's so much power in writing one's truth and one's perspective and one's worldview. I think about, and you know, I think poetry is, you know, a very immediate and emotive form. So that's my thoughts.
I just realised that you're all probably actually teachers of poetry as well, right? Like, or most of us. Jill, you certainly are.
Well, I was.
You taught me, Jill. We did a workshop. That's great. You taught me. Yeah, it was great. Okay.
And I still do it occasionally. Thank you.
Yeah, you do. I wonder about, you've been teaching poetry for probably many people in this audience, I would think, as well. Maybe. Is there something that, as you've taught over the years, have you felt a change in the way that poetry is received, in the way that its presence? Is there something? Do you feel like it's kind of functioned the way it always has? Have you felt any shifts on the wind?
I think that the performative, broadly speaking, performative aspect of it.
Yeah.
Has changed. And way back, probably before anyone's time, because I'm old, I'm ancient actually, people used to talk about page or stage.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole thing. Whereas I think now I see that poets, and indeed poets and prose writers, can work in different media, if I can use that term as broadly as possible. I'm mostly what is called a page poet, but I do like to get up and read, and I have done other performance-like moments in my life. Mm. I'm shy, but I do push myself to do that. And I see my students do that. I have, well, when I was teaching there, if they were doing music, they'd get up in a class and start playing. I'm not just thinking of someone playing a guitar or beatbox or something, but classical music students as well from the con, doing some stuff and thinking about how words and music, or others how words and movement, mm. or others how words in a digital environment might work differently to words on a page, to the live performance. So I've really noticed that kind of change. And yeah, people might say they're a performance poet, but all poems perform and all poets perform. We've all performed here, but would we call ourselves performance poets? Maybe yes, maybe no. What does that mean? Language performs. Mm. And of course, some people can't speak, so they have to do it in other ways. Mm. And I think, on the other hand, of course, you know, we could look at poets from ancient times and they've been sung, they've been performed. But I think in the cohort of students I've seen over the years, they've kind of left behind some of their ideas around, usually I ask them what they'd read, and it was either Tennyson or Wordsworth or Sylvia Plath. Mm. And I kind of thought, yeah, there's perhaps a bit more in between all of that.
Yeah.
Or they were what we call performance poets. I'm not dissing that, but a specific spoken word kind of milieu. But, you know, they'll do video and all this sort of thing. And I think because media has become so much more easier to use, sometimes used very badly, of course, but that's neither here nor there, they did some fabulous things. I mean, and also the other interesting thing was that they often did communal things. So it wasn't the one poet. It was a few people doing various bits and pieces to make something, whether it was on a page or a poster or a performance.
Mm. As someone who's taught for not anywhere near as long as you, maybe, judging by my age and your age, maybe, I am deeply impressed by my students constantly. Mm. And even over the last 5 years, have been deeply impressed by how much my students care about the world. And obviously there's outliers and you know, some students are more engaged than others, but I've seen a real momentum towards really young writers. Mm. I'm thinking here of a 7-year-old who wrote me, I did not prompt this, out of nowhere, writes me this anti-Trump poem, and it rhymed. She loved to rhyme the word Trump with things, and it was just like, I was like, you're 7.
A lot of potential.
Eh? Yeah, I was like, please, let's nurture. And she drew me a picture as well. Like, it was a really big day for me. But I think I'm really realizing more and more every time I enter a classroom, whether that's in a university or in like a freelance kind of way, that there is a growing understanding of the world and not just poetry as this like as pretty words, but poetry as a purpose.
Yeah.
You're in classrooms, I know, as well. How are you feeling about it?
When they let me in. Not even there to teach. I just like to hang out. I do think the space of poetry matters, right? We can talk about the difference in form and variation of tone and such and performance mode and stuff. But, like, all of that occurs in a space, whether it's on a page, whether it's in, like, a gallery or, you know, at a rally or, you know, at a bar. And I think, you know, people who are interested and invested in poetry have heard poetry in all of those spaces. I think the nice thing about poetry is you understand with a much fuller sense, and I think we treat like prose, you know, nonfiction and fiction and such. We really understand that like poetry does have a space in the air, you know, as a form of vocalization or performance. And you know, we're willing to do that and to engage and to enter into a space of listening. So I believe there would be more, you know, people talk about like a renaissance of poetry or this like this real like, you know, burst of interest in poetry. And I think what that is that perhaps we've just started to build a better infrastructure for poetry to be performed and to have a place in society that's taken a little bit more seriously and is a bit more accessible than historically ever before. And it does make me sad a little bit to think about all of the poets who never got their, who never did get their space and such.
Yeah, but I mean, my students would teach me more than I was teaching them, I'm pretty sure.
Always. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Definitely mine.
Yeah.
They teach me memes.
If they do that, the classroom's good. That's my rule. Yeah. If I'm learning from them, I'm a terrible teacher that day. Mm. Yeah.
I love it. We are sadly absolutely out of time. So please join me in thanking our wonderful poem, panel, God. our wonderful panel.
Let's thank the poetry.
The old poetry. Evelyn Araluen, Madison Godfrey, Alan Van Niven, and Jill Jones, thank you for reading your work. Thank you for joining us. Stunning audience. Stunning.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for braving
thanks
the heat.
All.
And thanks so much, Jess, for bringing it all together.
Thank you. You know, there was a beautiful moment, Alan, when you were reading and you said, like, in the poem, it was like you mentioned the wind and this cool breeze came through right at that moment, which was just amazing. Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Thank
we're getting off stage.
You.
Thanks.